Blog Talk Radio.
Techniques and things of that nature. Tonight I'm not. It's been a while since I put a show out. So I just intend to interview Mr. Greenlee and let him give us his thoughts and views and about his book. The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the movie, how we can compare it to things in a movie that went on yesterday, and what's going on today. We got a lot of problems in the community, people. And listen to a brother like this, just really, I feel the put us back on the right track because we've lost our way, so to speak. So we're gonna see what's going on. We're gonna see what's happening. Not sure, but I'm gonna run a few more clips. I'm not sure if this is him on the line, but. Hope he calls in soon. So I want to play some Gil Scott Heron, get us in the mood.
Uno, dos, uno, dos, tres, cuatro.
See that black
What you got going now is is good and important, but this has got to be done right now. And it would make a great movie, and I'll be able to help you do it. He was an actor and a writer. And so he went into Athens, and when he came back after several days, I gave him the first chapter to The Spook Who Sat by the Door. And the rest is history.
Oh, you play an instrument?
No, I sing.
You sing?
Yeah, well, I used to.
Okay. Because, you know, later on, I was thinking about you, you know, you doing some poetry for me here later on, okay?
That'll work.
Okay. So, you know, some of the people in the movie, I mean, what kind of hurdles did you...
Hold on, I can give you the shortest poem I ever wrote.
Go ahead.
A free black mind is a concealed weapon.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
You're going to need to add to that.
No.
But I want you to talk about the movie and what kind of hurdles that you encountered early on, and why did it? And how long did it take you to get to put the movie, bring the movie to the screen, to the big screen?
Well, not a long time. I met Ivan Dixon in '71 in Hollywood, and I was out there talking to Clarence Williams III about playing the lead in the movie. We thought we could use him to raise the money. And
Clarence Williams III, he's a conscious brother, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't see too much about him. But go ahead, continue. I'm sorry for cutting you out.
And he was playing in my squad at the time.
Right.
And Ivan was directing an episode. And he mentioned it, Ivan, that I was in town. And Ivan wanted to talk to me. But Clarence was reluctant to give him, tell him where I was, because he thought Ivan wanted to play the role. And Ivan said, no, I don't want to play it, I want to direct it. And I'd love to direct you in the role. So he called me and came out to the hotel and said he'd like to direct the film. And I said, well, I got a script. It blew him away. So it turned out he couldn't raise any money to option the film. So I said, well, look, let's form a partnership. And we'll both have 50% of nothing. And that's how I jumped out.
Okay, you wrote the book first.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write the book?
First draft, 4 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The book just wrote it.
Go off by yourself or what? Just every day you're going to work or something?
Same way I do today. Writing is my job, man. It's not my hobby.
Okay.
I sit down every day. What's that?
I like that. I like it.
Well, that's what it is, you know. I can tell the hobbyists when I read a book. I know they're just shucking and jabbing. They ain't really serious.
Right.
Somebody asked me one time if I only wrote when I was inspired. And I laughed and I said, if I did, I'd write about 6 times a year.
Wow.
So, I sit down every day and I write. And when I've done my quota, I get up. Student last week asked me if I wrote in my spare time. I said, no. I said, I hustle rent in my spare time. Writing is my gig.
I want you to go ahead and finish. I'm sorry, brother. I didn't want to go ahead and interrupt you.
Well, at this point, my major income is selling books and DVDs out of my shoulder bag and on the internet, because I'm on a fixed income, and my rent and utilities eat up most of it.
Wow. Yeah, we're gonna deal with that in a minute, hopefully. But some of the actors in the movie, are you in contact with some of the ones that are still around today?
No.
And some of those people there that were in the movie, none of them got in touch with you or tried to go ahead and say, maybe let's do a Spook Who Sat by the Door 2?
Well, they're too old for it now.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, and compare.
The only two survivors of the leading roles were Janet Leigh, who played Joy, and Jay Preston, who played the cop. And Preston and I ain't speaking. We sell out.
Why is that?
Well, he's just hard to get along with.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so,
I just want you to get to some comparisons of what put you in that mindset that back then, and compare that to what's going on today, and try to cover some of the stuff in between.
Well, at that time, it was either do it or write it. I decided to write it. Because I've meant everything I put into that book, and don't regret it.
We a lot of us are glad you don't regret it. Because I'm just looking at it to where, I'm just trying to look at the parallels, because the stuff that's going on in the book and what brought, the brothers to do what they did, I feel that they had to, but I don't see that kind of mindset today. I see a lot of foolishness today.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
See the same?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a big problem.
I'm on a Facebook page, and time after time after time, people get on a page talking about they are slaves and oppressed by white supremacy. And once you say that, you surrendered, man. I don't understand. I don't understand this generation. They got about a dozen of them, man. All they do is whine and complain about white folks. So I asked them, okay, what you doing about it? I never got one response. Because they ain't doing nothing about it.
Right. I see a lot of people whining and complaining, but I don't see too much people really doing a lot of things. I see a little movements, little groups here and there, but they're moving like snails. And it's mostly I see a lot of individuals mostly doing things to heighten their prestige, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? Really not to go ahead and do it for the people. And not like what I saw in the movie, not to go ahead and bring us up and things like that. I think you have another person here that might want to ask you a question. You want to take a quick question and we get back to it?
Sure.
How you doing, caller? 252. State your name, where you're calling from.
Peace and blessings, Rob. This is Big Rick. How you doing tonight?
All right, how you doing, Big Rick?
Can't complain. And brother Sam Greenlee, I just want to tell you that, it's not that I have a question. It's that there's something that you had said when you wrote the book. It was like either, write the book or do what the book was talking about. And one thing that, struck me is what you're talking about. Because, I mean, I had a conversation with somebody and, if they listen to this blog talk, they know what I'm talking about. And they were talking about AFRICOM and writing some petition up. And I said, I don't want to write no petition. I thought you were talking about doing something for real. I thought you were talking about bullets. I don't want no ballots. If you're really talking about it, and I'm not one of those people that I don't really talk that aggressively. Especially, on the air, which really is nothing anyway. I mean, they're getting ready to do all this other stuff with Blog Talk. But it's like, I remember watching this film, and I was probably about 11 years old. And I think I wrote to you when I, befriended you on Facebook, how my mother took me to see this film. And this film was so, you could never have called this film blaxploitation. Because it was a mindset that was in this film that this is plausible and feasible. So, when you talk about, the different actions and the places that you were and you saw these, these ideals, to stop the oppression within those particular countries and it being, acted out and successfully done. And then we sit here in America, and all we do is talk. We want to petition, you know, the imperialist powers for our rights. I mean, that's all I want to say.
Okay, brother.
You gonna stay with us, Big Rick?
Oh yeah, indeed.
Stay with. I'm leaving the line open. How do you feel about that, Mr. Greenlee?
Well, I think I was talking to Oscar Brown Jr. one time, and I made the same kind of statement. And Oscar challenged me. He said, whose fault is it that these young bloods ain't doing what you think they should be doing? And I said, it's our generation's fault. We didn't school them in the way we had been schooled in how to survive and overcome racism. I don't know why that is, but we got a whole generation out there doing on-the-job training. And by the time they realize what's going on, it'll be too late. The time for armed revolution is no longer necessary. What we need to be doing is to rebuilding the hood as a safe haven it once was. You're not old enough to know what Chicago was like 50 years ago. It was a marvelous place to live on the South Side. We owned hotels. We owned banks. We owned nightclubs, ballrooms, small and large businesses. And you know what killed all that? Integration. Integration.
You know, that's thrown around a lot. How do you feel about that? Hey, I need you to elaborate on that.
Well, when the movement jumped off, it wasn't about integration. The Montgomery bus boycott didn't have nothing to do with integration. Plessy versus Ferguson wasn't about integration. It was about desegregation. And when the assimilationists came in, they claimed that the opposite of segregation was integration. And once they got in control, it was over. Because as soon as they got what they wanted, they abandoned the movement. COINTELPRO didn't kill the movement. It was betrayed and abandoned by the bourgeois leadership. And all of those businesses I indicated are gone because black people rushed up on the north side to give their money to the white folks who a week before wouldn't let them in the back door.
And now look at the south side.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm going to take a quick, brother. I want you to go ahead and listen to this clip, and I want you to tell me what you think about it, okay?
Okay.
You too, Big Rick, all right?
Yeah, peace.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened to them have upon us? Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungle, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And why, then naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of, an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully made you and me hate our African identity. our African characteristics, and you know yourself that we have been a people who hated our African characteristics. We hated our hair. We hated the shape of our nose. We wanted one of those long, dog-like noses, you know. Yeah. We hated the color of our skin. Hated the blood of Africa that was in our veins. And in hating our features and our skin and our blood, why, we had to end up hating ourselves. And we hated ourselves. Our color became to us a chain. We felt that it was holding us back. Our color became to us like a prison, which we felt was keeping us confined, not letting us go this way or that way. And we felt that all of these restrictions were based solely upon our color, and the psychological reaction to that would have to be that as long as we felt imprisoned or chained or trapped by black skin, black features, and black blood, that skin and those features and that blood that was holding us back automatically had to become hateful to us. And it became hateful to us. It made us feel inferior. It made us feel inadequate. It made us feel helpless. And when we fell victim to this feeling of inadequacy or inferiority or helplessness, we turned to somebody else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in another black man to show us the way, or black people to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think a black man could do anything but play some horn, you know, some sound, and make you happy with some songs, and in that way. But when an inferior thing, where our food, clothing, and shelter was concerned, and our education was concerned, we turned to the man. We never thought in terms of bringing these things into existence for ourselves. We never thought in terms of doing things for ourselves, because we felt helpless. And what made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves. One of the things that made the black Muslim movement grow was its emphasis upon things African. This was the secret to the growth of the black Muslim movement. African blood, African origin, African culture, African ties. And you'd be surprised. We discovered that deep within the subconscious of the black man in this country, he's still more African than he is American. He thinks that he's more American than African because the man is jiving him and the man is brainwashing him every day, telling him, you're an American. Man, how could you think you're an American and you have never had any kind of American treat over here? You have never, never. 10 men can be sitting at a table eating, you know, dining. And I can come and sit down where they're dining. They're dining. I got a plate in front of me, but nothing is on it. Because all of us sitting at the same table are all of us diners. I'm not a diner until you let me dine. Then I become a diner. Just being at the table with others who are dining doesn't make me a diner. And this is what you got to get in your head here in this country. Just because you're in this country doesn't make you an American. And no, you got to go farther than that before you can become an American. You've got to enjoy the fruits of Americanism. And you haven't enjoyed those fruits. You've enjoyed the thorns. You've enjoyed the thistles. But you have not enjoyed the fruits. No, sir. So I point these things out, brothers and sisters, so that you and I will know the importance in 1965 of being in complete unity with each other, harmony with each other, and not letting the man maneuver us into fighting one another. I say that again, that I'm not a racist. I don't believe in any form of segregation or anything like that. I'm for the brotherhood of everybody, but I don't believe in forcing brotherhood upon people who don't want it. As long as we practice brotherhood among ourselves, and then others who want to practice brotherhood with us, we practice it with them also. We're for that. But I don't think that we should run around trying to love somebody who doesn't love us. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Greenlee, yeah. You know, looking at the movie, that the light-skinned brother, he got upset, and he was saying that, hey, look, you want me to go do this? You want to pick all the yellow brothers to do this? Yada yada. And he said, hey, he's more blacker than everybody else. You know, listen to what you just listened to, and I want you to just give me your thoughts and put it all together and go ahead and tell me how you feel about that clip, and also try to bring it from a point of view. From that the light skinned brother that was in, I can't remember the character's name right now.
Freddie Willis.
What is it?
Well, Freddie Willis.
Okay.
Well, I would take exception with some of those comments.
Okay.
It was an open statement. He was trying to make a point. But Elijah Muhammad And Malcolm X didn't invent nationalism. You got to go all the way back to David Walker, okay, and Martin R. Delaney and Frederick Douglass, okay, all the way down through Robert S. Abbott, Ida B. Wells, W.E.B. Du Bois, all of whom were saying what he was saying just 50 years ago. Now, much of what he said, I would agree with. It would indeed blacks among us who hated themselves for exactly that reason. But there were also others, and many of them mentored me, who were saying that kind of thing before Malcolm and I were born. Furthermore, the interest in Africa has undergone a total transformation. I was studying Africa when I was 10 years old. So I certainly didn't fall in the category of self-hatred, as he pointed out, and neither did most of my classmates, because my first introduction to black history was at 10 years old in McCosh Grammar School on 64th and Champlain, which is now Emmett Till Academy. So,
yeah.
So much of what he said was true, but I think it was also overstated. And what I see now is an immense interest in things African. Every time you look up, somebody's got an African name. They're letting their hair grow. They're not bleaching their skin. They're proud of who and of what we are and how we look. And that was because of what people like Malcolm and I and our elders had done. Otherwise, most black people would be replica of the people he was talking about. So I would agree with most of what he said, but I think much of it was overstated.
But okay, which parts were overstated?
That few, if any, of the people of that time had any interest whatever in Africa, that most of us hated ourselves, and that was not true. Now, many, perhaps even most, fit in that category. But the idea that only he and a handful of people in the Nation of Islam were on the right road was what he had to say, because he was a spokesman for the Nation of Islam. But I can guarantee you there were more than just a handful of black people who fell in the category of being liberated. And I was one of them.
What do you think about all these movements today? You know, you got the Moorish Science Temple, and you got the Hebrew Israelites, and the 5%ers. What do you think about all of them today?
Well, you know, I think it's satisfying for the people who belong in those institutions, but I think they're much too insular and are not doing the kinds of things that I think should be doing in the community at large. It's one thing to gather at a temple and reinforce one's feeling of superiority and reinforce one's connection with Africa, but what do you do when you leave there? What are you doing to spread the word? What are you doing to educate our young people?
Education is the key.
Yeah, you know, if you claim to be among the few or a handful of people who are liberated, that's not only anti-historical, it's intellectual masturbation. If you're not doing anything for the hood, then sit down and shut up.
So how would those groups and your idea for putting the book together, how would those groups have fit into the spook who sat by the door? Would they fit in?
No, because they're not going to start a revolution, and they're not doing anything that I can see of value to the community at large. Okay.
Even today's new Black Panther Party, how do you feel about them?
I really don't know that much about them. Some time ago, I was invited down to Atlanta by the chapter of the new Black Panther Party, and I screened the film for them, and I thought there were some very strong, vibrant young black men and women. But confrontation is no longer necessary. Building the hood is necessary. And I told him, I said, what you need to do is an about face. Turn your rear end to white folks and turn your face towards us. Rebuild the school systems. I got a better education when I was going to grammar school in the 40s than young people are getting in Chicago today. And what killed the public school system? Once again, integration. I used to argue with the rabid integrationists who insisted on busing to attain integration. I said, well, what's wrong with being able to go to school around the corner from you? But that would be segregation. I said, well, I ain't got no problem with voluntary segregation. I live in the hood when I could live anywhere in the city. I don't want to live in Hyde Park. I'm living in Woodlawn. And I told him this. I told him this. If you keep on busing people, whites are going to leave the system. And when that happens, underfunding comes. And at that time, the public school system in Chicago was 52% white and 48% black. Now it's 8% white. And the results are obvious. Do you know DuSable High School produced some of the greatest jazz musicians we've ever had? And they don't.
Yes, I know that.
They
know
don't even teach music there anymore. Because the first thing they cut are the arts and music programs. Look, man, we paid a terrible price for integration. Terrible price. All of the institutions I talked about are gone. Because of integration. The public school system is going down the tubes because of integration. And the only people who profited from integration was the class that led the movement. That was a mass movement. The vast majority of the people who were in those demonstrations were ordinary working class black people. The first row, maybe the first two rows, were celebrities and organizers. After that, you had factory workers and chauffeurs and what have you who were marching. Once they got affirmative action, once doors opened in corporations and government that weren't there anymore, the bourgeoisie moved on. They don't even want to live in the ghetto anymore. Take Detroit, for instance. It's a ghost city after dark.
Yeah.
The vast majority of educated blacks moved out of the city. The same is true of Washington, D.C. At least in Chicago, it didn't happen. They just expanded the ghetto out to the city limits. But we no longer live among one another, regardless of class. Not like when I was growing up. Now, don't get me wrong. It wasn't a utopia, but it was far better place to live than it is today. I'll give you an example. I ran across a bound copy of E. Franklin Frazier's Master's Thesis. And in it, he compared black businesses versus white businesses in Harlem and the South Side. In Harlem, whites outnumbered black businesses in Harlem 5-1. In Chicago, it was about 50-50. We've always been the bastion of black nationalism. Well, no accident that Elijah Muhammad came here. He wasn't born and raised in Chicago, but he must have known that he would be welcome here and protected here. My guess is Marcus Garvey had come to Chicago, he'd have died in bed instead of in exile in London.
What do you think about the Marcus Garvey movement and the different Back to Africa movements today, the nationhoods and building a nation? What do you think about that?
I think it was inspiration, and much of and it had a strong and powerful influence on the civil rights movement. But even Garvey didn't invent Back to Africa. Martin Luther Delaney made 3 visits to Africa and signed a treaty with several of the chiefs in Nigeria, granting land for those blacks in the United States who wanted to migrate to Africa. But the British put their foot down on that. They didn't want to see a bunch of free blacks out of the United States settling in Nigeria. That would have been dangerous. The only 2 places where we had any significant return were Liberia and Sierra Leone. Now, the whites talked about Back to Africa because they wanted to get rid of us. But there were others who thought it would be better to go back to the homeland than to remain here. So all of these movements have roots dating back to the 18th century. We don't know it because we don't know our history. But I know history. And I didn't wait for a white man to teach it to me either. I dug it out on my own.
That was something I saw also with Dr. Clark, with Dr. Henry Clark. It was a video I saw of Dr. Clark, and he was saying how he was in grade school, and he was wondering, you know, what did his people do, and he was asking the white schoolmaster, you know, what did his people do in history, and the white schoolmaster told him, hey, your people done nothing in history, and we're gonna go ahead and teach you history. Wow, I don't think they're pretty much saying that now; they're just showing you that now. You feel the same way?
Look, man, I'm a perfect example of the other side of the coin. I was taught in grammar school by black teachers. I remember Miss McNeil, who taught music, would sit at the piano and explain to us how the spirituals were actually code. Okay? For instance, go down, Moses, set my people free.
Right.
Or sometimes I feel like a motherless child. You know who represented mother in that song? Mother Africa, a long way from home. If you understand what the spirituals were about, you have to understand that the slaves who wrote them were writing about freedom and a return to the motherland. Now, I wouldn't expect any white man to teach me that. Probably wouldn't know. But I'm grateful that my black female teachers taught me that. To whine about the white version of history is not good enough. We've had many, many historians, Chancellor Williams, Dr. Henry Clark, Dr. Ben, and others, who have been writing our version of history. And stop whining about what they say and dig out what we say.
Mm-hmm.
The most unused building in the ghetto is the library. And I think the best way to get black people in there is put "for whites only" on the door.
agree. I have to agree.
Man, I lived in the last grade when I was a child.
Right.
And
that education system going? How do we get to educate everyone about themselves, their history, and who they are? What are your thoughts? What are your views about that?
Well, we've been educating ourselves for 700 years. You know, we do more than break dance at black colleges. Okay. A number of those colleges were founded by rich white Southerners to educate their bastard mulatto children. But there were others who were built by black finances. So we've been teaching ourselves for centuries. Who was teaching black people in the segregated South if it wasn't black people? You know, that idea that we were brainless, oppressed, beaten down slaves before people like Malcolm and others came along is a myth. We've been struggling against white oppression since the day we got here. You got any idea how many slave revolts there were before emancipation? Take a guess.
Oh, I had a list of them. You know what? I would like to find them right quick. I'm going to have to go ahead and do a show on that because I've seen that there were lots. And if you go ahead and look at the calendar year, it was damn near one every day in some areas.
Yep.
And then this thing about we didn't fight back, which I saw that's just not true. That's
all
that miseducation.
All they're teaching in school is about three. Nat Turner, Gabrielle, and Denmark Vesey. Now, there's a book that you need to read. It's called Negro Slave Revolts in North America. It's written by a white man named Herbert Aptheker. His definition of a slave revolt was a plot carried out by more than 10 people. And he admitted that there were many more small revolts. But he documented more than 250 slave revolts by 10 or more people in North America.
You don't talk to
people whose only knowledge of slavery is roots. They ain't got nothing to do with slavery.
Well, you know, can I chime in on this?
Exactly what he was doing when he wrote that book. There wasn't a slave revolutionary in the book. Kunta Kinte got to be one of the dumbest black people ever written. He's going to get whipped because he won't change his name? That's dumb. If it had been me, I'd say, yes, sir, boss, my name's Toby. And then go down to the slave quarters and say, hey, y'all, up there at the White House, I'm Toby. Down here, I'm Kunta Kinte. Furthermore, he was allegedly, he must have been a graduate of Bush School. But when he revolted, he couldn't even follow the North Star to get away. And when he got caught, he was shivering and starving. And he had grown up in a jungle. And he couldn't find a means to eat fruit, fish, small game.
Yeah.
Come on. That's why I'm broke. He died wealthy because he told the tale of white man they got no problem with. They love to read about suffering in Negroes.
Mm.
And it's still going down. You got feelings like precious. You know, white folks ate it up. But a film like The Spook Was Out the Door, it was suppressed by the FBI for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't write about black victims. I write about black victors. And I'm not a victim. I'm a victor. I've been outsmarting and outmaneuvering white folks since I was a child. And when somebody says that they are an oppressed slave, I look for the nearest exit. I don't want to be around those slaves.
Rick, you had a question?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that he was saying that I felt was very relevant, and one of the things that I found was very interesting was the slave narratives. And, you know, the slave narratives, when they were written, they had three basic themes. But no matter, you cannot in your lifetime read all the slave narratives because they went around to different states and they talked to a lot of people. And one of the main three themes I found were, one, they didn't like white people. Two, they tried to escape every chance they got. And three, they did not trust their religion. And then you look at today, it's like they love white people. You know, they want to stay here in America. And they took their religion hook, line, and sinker. Now, the other thing that I thought was very interesting about, you know, is like Brother Greenlee was talking about, is that, you know, we didn't have this this feeling of, you know, wanting to integrate within their own system, and we had many venues in terms of businesses, and one of the greatest venues we had was the movie industry. And it seemed as if the closer that we got out of the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, a lot of the feelings of unity and business were almost taken away, and, you know, we were in a state that we're in today where very few have the opportunities for financial success, and that, you know, most of us are put into a perplexing situation of being, you know, paid less than what we're worth, and then we don't know how to recycle our communities to reflect, you know, the monies that can, you know, that can help employ us and get us, you know, the services that we need outside of always looking for government help.
Yeah, bro, we used to. I'm glad you mentioned about the black film industry. You got any idea how long it lasted?
I think it was maybe about 20 or 30 years.
The first white feature film was made in 1912. The first black feature film was made in 1914. What killed the black film industry was Technicolor. When they brought out a half a dozen black-oriented films in Hollywood and showed black people in glorious color, it put people like Spencer Williams and Oscar Micheaux at a disadvantage. Black people didn't want to see themselves in black and white. We had a film industry until well into the early 50s. I used to go to a theater on 58th and Prairie, and it was run by a progressive Jewish man. And on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, he had second-run Hollywood films. But Monday through Thursday, he showed black-made films. You got any idea where Oscar Micheaux's studio was? On the south side of Chicago. Spencer Williams shot his films in Harlem. But...
What's interesting when you talk about the movie industry, period, right? When my mother took me to see your film, we had to go way outside of our neighborhood to see it. It was only playing at one movie theater. So within a 10-block radius, there were about five different movie theaters. But we had to go, like, we had to go from one side because we lived in Hunts Point, and we had to go all the way to Yankee Stadium because it was the theater was about one block away from Yankee Stadium. So we had to go from one side of the Bronx to the other side of the Bronx in order to see your film. Though we had like five movie theaters on one stretch in an area, you know, not too far from where we live.
Well, you know how we made the film? Ivan took the film to all of the major Hollywood studios. It was six. And I knew they weren't going to pick it up. So I got together with a young Jewish man that I'd gone to University of Chicago with, who was a business consultant. And we wrote a proposal to raise $1.5 million. And 85 cents of every dollar of that film came from independent black investors. But all of the filmmakers I know now want to go to Hollywood. Most of them. But it never occurred to me I had to go to Hollywood to make the film, because I had examples like Oscar Michel. Go to the hood, get the money. Then you can shoot what you want. But if you take their money, you got to shoot what they want. It's simple. He who pays the paper calls the tune.
Go ahead. Oh, well, I was going to say, I have another call on the line. 314, your line is open. State your name, where you're calling from.
Yes, hello?
Okay.
Hello?
How you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Rob? I'm just going to listen for a couple more moments, and I'll chime in, but I'm online, and I'll raise my hand in a couple more minutes, okay?
Okay.
Mr.
Greenlee. Okay, thanks.
Hello.
Thanks. Yes, Mr. Greenlee. With the entertainers now, I'm talking about the actors, musicians, athletes, you know, these people that are out there in front of, they're always on TV, and a lot of us know them. Do you really think they're helping us or hurting us? And like with a film like yours, you know, what do you think they really say about that?
Well, man, when I grew up, the entertainers and the professional athletes lived in the hood. Okay. I don't know one pro athlete in Chicago who lives on the south side. They're out in the suburbs or on the north side. They live on a different planet. They have no... The only thing they can do for us is entertain. And they don't dare say anything that the white masses don't want them to say. So, you know, they're just there. All I ask for black entertainer is to be entertaining and shut up about politics, because they ain't going to say anything or do anything for us. Now, there's some who have... institutions where they collect money of value to the community, but they're few and far between.
Can I ask you about Melvin Van Peebles and his film, Sweet Facts, Badass Song? I mean, in comparison to your film, and you know, they're crediting, you know, Melvin Van Peebles with creating blaxploitation films. How did you feel about that classification?
Well, he did, but I wouldn't call it a blaxploitation film. It was much more serious than that. I called Sweetback and Spook the bookends of that. After Spook came out, black people didn't want to see that BS. And that ended the blaxploitation era. I went to grammar school with Melvin Van Peebles.
Wow. He from the show?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He moved out into Chicago Heights when he was like 12 years old. But prior to that time, he grew up on 58th Street.
Chicago Heights ain't real.
What's that?
Chicago Heights is a little rough now, ain't it?
Yeah. It wasn't at the time. I went to grammar school, high school, and college with Lorraine Hansberry.
Are there any of these black leaders today, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, the Farrakhans, do you see them really helping or hurting us?
I think they're helping their bank accounts. I admire much of what the Nation of Islam is doing. For instance, they got an excellent grammar school and high school over there at the mosque on Stony Island. And they've offered me solid support over the years. And I like what they're doing. They don't just talk about doing things for the community. They do it. They own businesses.
Yeah.
They employ black people. And they're not insular. They're out in the hood. You know, you got these young brothers selling the final call. You got them working in hospitals. You got them operating businesses. They don't just talk, they do.
Yeah, that's a nice big place.
I would separate Farrakhan from the other two people you talk about.
Okay. Back in the day, because I seen some stuff on how James Brown was really trying to do some stuff. Did you meet him?
No, I never met him.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was more. You ever listen to Max Roach's Freedom Suite?
No.
Or
let
too
me
much
know.
Of this stuff? What's that?
Educate me. Let me know.
He did a whole symphony about black freedom, Africa, and the rest of it. Check it out. It's a whole album. It's hard to get a hold of. You have people like Charlie Mingus, who was writing that kind of music. Dizzy Gillespie was down front about the civil rights movement. It was far more than just James Brown. All he did was make one record.
Mm-hmm.
And got rid of his process, and as soon as the movement was over, he went on back to conking his hair again.
Wow.
I saw a pretty good documentary on the civil rights movement. And they talked about
what was that?
It was on PBS. So I can't remember what it's called. But they talked about the writers who were involved in the movement, but they did not talk about the graphic artists and the musicians who were intrinsic in the civil rights movement.
You know what? Name some of the graphic artists. Name some of those guys who were taking pictures or painting portraits. Name some of those people.
Well, there was Jeff Donaldson, who organized a group of Chicago black artists into an Afro-Cobra. And you might know about the Wall of Respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Put up pictures of leading of black leaders, and that was done by Afro-Cobra. I don't know why the emphasis is just on the writers, because I was shoulder to shoulder with photographers and sculptors and graphic and painters, all who were lending their effort to the movement.
Thing that killed the movement, you know, it was integration. Was there anything else?
Oh, yeah. It was COINTELPRO. There were police departments. 28 Black Panthers were shot down by police across the country. Mark Clark and Fred Hampton Sr. were killed in 1968. So it was a two-edged sword. They approached us with a carrot and a stick. The stick was infiltration, blackmail, murder, incarceration, and the carrot was affirmative action and integration. But I don't want to minimize the achievements of that movement.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have much of what we have today if it hadn't existed.
So the benefits of the movement today, what do you see?
We got three million black people in colleges and universities, and a million of them graduate every year.
Now you mentioned to me earlier that there was a number of schools that wouldn't allow you to teach. Talk about that for a minute.
What can I say? Chicago.
Yeah.
University of Chicago, where I once attended, Northwestern University, Kennedy King College, Chicago State University, the Center for Inner City Studies, have turned me down for teaching positions.
Hmm.
All of them.
Did they all give you the same reason?
They don't give no reason.
Like it was a... They gave you the same reason or just said no, you know, sorry, we can't do it. You know, give me an example of what they said to you.
Oh, at Chicago State, they invited me down for a lengthy interview that included black professors. And after I left there, they voted not to hire me. And then I was told they didn't have the budget to hire me.
You know, someone told me a little while ago that a lot of the black professors are today pretty much working for the FBI and CIA. Is there any truth to that, or how do you feel about that?
They ain't working for the CIA, man. When you train a dog not to defecate in the house, you don't have to be there. He ain't going to do it. And if you change somebody being Uncle Tom, you don't have to tell them what to do. They've been trained to do it. So, no, they ain't work for no CIA. And they're well paid for it. At the colleges I'm talking about, you start out $50,000 a year to teach 9 months and maybe 9 hours a week. You give somebody like that a gig, he's safe and he's tame. Now, there are exceptions. There are people out there I know who are doing some solid work in the classroom. But the rest of them ain't doing nothing going to make massive mad.
I really feel the education system is shot in Illinois, because I've seen it, and they were parading it. They were putting it on TV, and then the news agencies was putting it out there. When they were talking about terms of the U.S., Illinois is 48th in education. But something else I was looking at was how...
Hold on. It's the black thing.
Say it again?
Look, they're not educating white people in this country anymore.
Yeah. I've noticed that. They were talking about the education system here was when they put the U.S. up against other countries, they said it was like 14th, and the U.S. was 14th in reading. The thing I saw just today, I believe, today or yesterday, the U.S. is 20. The U.S. is 17th in science and 25th in math.
Mm-hmm.
So in our community, I think it's a lot worse.
Well, you know, I was talking to a sister today, and, you know, she's you know, trying to, you know, get her higher education. I mean, I think she does already have some college courses, and she was saying she had a problem with college math. So, you know, I Googled it up, you know, because you know, I already did college math and all that, so I don't remember even what it looks like, but I know that a lot of what they call college math is just algebra and all these, you know, applications of math that you will never use in the real world. You know, unless you're doing engineering, you know, the type of formulas that they're talking about, you know, and I've done accounting for many businesses in over 25 years, and those college math problems they have up there and those formulas never came into play. And I've made many reviews of balance sheets and all the rest of this stuff, and I'm like, you know, what is this technology that they're using in order to confuse people into thinking that this is what you need in order to have a job? And it's farthest from the truth if the area in which those formulas are being used have nothing to do with what they've taught you there.
Right. I agree. Mr. Greeley.
Yeah.
You know, Spike Lee, he put out his, I've seen somebody else that had written something about Spike Lee. Spike Lee's movie about Malcolm X.
Yeah.
They were saying the Haylock, they were, pretty much this person was saying, well, a lot of that wasn't really true. Do you see really a person like Spike Lee or the Singleton dudes, I feel they're not on your level. Do you think they're really good directors, or should they really tackle the problems in the community, or should they just leave it alone?
I'd rather they left it alone.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Because they're walking a tightrope. If they attempted to do what I did, they'd be shut down. So they do the best they can within that context. They have to give us enough to pull us into the theaters, but give them enough to make their next film. And I tell young filmmakers, if you want to say something cutting edge about black people, you can't say it in Hollywood. Go to the hood like we did, raise your money, and you can say anything you want to say. Why would white executives in Hollywood want to promote anything of value to us as a people? It ain't gonna happen.
The CD that you give me, Mr. Greenlee, excuse me. The CD that you give me, I was listening to what Robert Towns was saying. He said, and you said it. You know, you couldn't find the spook sat by the door for, you know, the FBI had it suppressed for like, you know, 30 years. And he was saying that, hey, look, they was using your film as something to study in different college courses.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, you know, unfortunately, you know, I watched his film. I mean, again, I watched it in the movie theater. You know, I rented it on VHS. I've also on Netflix. But right now, you can watch your home film on Google.
On YouTube.
Yeah.
No. Nuh-uh. Google. Well, YouTube may not have the whole film, but I mean, Google has the film in its entirety.
Yeah, well, on YouTube, they got it in like 10-minute segments.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Google, you can watch the whole film, 1 hour, 42 minutes.
Mm.
I mean, Mr. Green, did you know that?
Yeah.
Do they give you any type of compensation for that?
I ain't got no problem with it. I want people to see it, okay? If I had wanted to make some money, I wouldn't have made the film like it was. So if you can see it free on Google, go for it. I'd rather you send me $20 and buy a DVD.
Well, I hear that.
Okay, but I ain't got no problem with people watching it free. I want people to watch it.
You know, Mr. Greenlee, for the people that's listening, I want you to go ahead and give them you can give them some of your contact information. You can put, give me, let them know your email address so they can contact you.
Well, they can call me. My telephone number is 773-288-6877. Now get out your pencil, and I'll repeat that later on. All you got to do is call me, and I'll tell you how you can get a hold of my book and my film.
Tell them about your latest works, because you know I had you gave you know I got the book from you, and I put it down, and my cousin came by and he just swiped the whole thing. I never got a chance to read it. I never once because I had the DVD on top, and my cousin was like, "Wow, you got this?" And like I said, "Yeah." And I told him because I know him. I said, "Don't touch it." So we talked for a minute. We messed around the house, and then he left. He left real quick. And before I know it, that thing was gone. And I've been calling. He said, "Yeah, I'm looking at the movie right now." And he's trying to pass around. But your latest works, the Baghdad Blues.
Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to go ahead and get a chance to read. I only read like a couple of pages, then I got kind of busy. So kind of explain a little bit about your latest works.
Well, Baghdad Blues was actually published in 76. I reprinted it 2 years ago. And it's autobiographical, and it deals with my experiences during the Baghdad Revolution.
Oh, that's why I was talking about the party scenes in the beginning. Okay.
Yeah, so, the party scene just indicates how fed up this brother is with what he sees around him, and he wants to get out of the States and see the world. And when he gets out to the Baghdad, it changes his mind and his personality in the same way that it changed mine. I became a revolutionary in Baghdad because I was inspired by the revolution. And then I never written Spook.
Did you ever get to meet Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael?
One time, when he was still at Howard, I came back from my first tour of duty, and I went by to see the director of athletics, Sam Barnes, that I met when we were on the State Department tour. And he said, "The person you got to talk to find out what's going on is Stokely Carmichael. He's over there in the student union." So I went over there, and he looked me up and down and said, "What you want?" I said, I'd like to talk to you about what you're doing." He said, "I don't have time. You can talk to somebody out there." And that's the last time I talked to him. And I ain't liked him since.
Wow.
I admire what he did, but that attitude turned me off. You know, he didn't know who I was or what I was about.
I still have another caller. Because we got like 10 minutes left. I want to get the thoughts and views. 314, the line is open. Do you have any questions for Mr. Greenlee?
Yes, sir. Good evening, Rob. And Mr. Greenlee, this has been truly a fascinating interview that Rob has done. Rob, you've done an excellent job. And I'd like to thank you very much, sir, for getting on Rob's show and sharing your experiences and your thoughts. I was very fortunate to have seen your movie, and of course, it was very inspirational. Like you, like Rob, I am former military, former Marine captain, graduated from Annapolis back in '88, and like you, sir, when I left the country, that's when I changed politically myself when I lived overseas. After the first Gulf War in Somalia, after I got out,
and was tired of getting shot at. I said, okay, let me get out of the country. And so I lived overseas for about 11 years.
Where?
And Singapore and Malaysia.
Okay.
Yep.
I've been to both places. I served in Indonesia for 2 years.
Did you?
Yeah, foreign service.
Did you? Okay. I had a business in Indonesia. Indonesia is a beautiful place. Nice people.
Gorgeous place.
Yeah, beautiful people.
Yeah.
What years were you
there? Before I interrupted you.
No, I'm sorry, sir. What years were you there?
I was there 60 to 62.
Mm. Very interesting.
I ain't no puppy. I'm 80 years old, bro.
Well, brother, sir, you sound awesome. And it's, once again, it is such an honor to speak with you. But in any event, sir, we formed an organization called the International African American Caucus. And one of the things that we did was we looked at ourselves politically and firmly believe in our right to return back to Africa to create an independent African American nation on the homeland of our ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us are, once again, former military professionals. We're not preachers and we're not teachers. We are individuals who have been out in the world, who understand the art of war, understand how to defend themselves, but yet also understand how to build and maintain the proper infrastructure that is necessary for a nation to be built. So we are an organization that has no ties with Reverend Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or Minister Farrakhan. We respect everyone. We do believe in the best for Africa like everyone else. However, we are focusing specifically on the African-American themselves. Just like the Israelis have their piece of land, we feel that we want to acquire what our mission is to acquire 10,000 square miles of unoccupied and undeveloped territory on the continental home of our ancestors, and then create this new independent African American nation with competent professionals and of those who wish to go. If you don't want to go, keep your black ass here in America.
Where are you going to get the money?
The money, sir, will be raised once the government is formed. Once we form a government, our legitimate government then is able to issue the bonds that will be necessary for us to begin the infrastructure projects, the acquisition of the land and the major infrastructure projects. Say, for instance, the airport and the port. Those are the two key critical projects that have to be started immediately on acquisition of land.
Well,
now, if we
have money to buy the land, aren't you? How are you going to get it?
Sir, we don't believe that we have to buy any piece of land in Africa. We will negotiate with African nations for this piece of territory, but I think it is an affront, and I also believe that it is an insult to the African American to have to say to them, well, our ancestors' land was stolen from them, and now you want us to go buy what you stole from us. That is unacceptable.
Okay.
That is absolutely unacceptable. And I think that is the line that we are drawing in the sand.
Okay. Where would you like to establish this nation? Where?
Well, sir, we do feel that our claim is definitely in West Africa. We have identified certain areas in which we feel that would allow us to obtain this piece of territory. So to answer your question, specifically Western Africa, we have locations that have vast tracts of unoccupied and undeveloped territory that we can build this nation on. So there are many areas. You go all the way up from Namibia, all the way up through Liberia, along that western coast, you will find vast tracts of land. And people just don't realize how vast the continent of Africa is. It is 2.5 times the size of the United States, including the landmass of Alaska.
3.5.
There is vast tracts of land in which there's nothing there.
Well, to the choir, I'm aware of this.
Yes, sir.
But
absolutely.
I would like to know, or maybe you don't want to divulge this information at this point. I was just wondering which of these African nations now you'd like to negotiate with?
Once again, sir, as you well know, we have certain areas that are identified. We can talk at a later date, but there are areas in which we feel that are good locations.
I understand. This is something that we would have to discuss in private.
Yes, sir.
I know it would be premature for you to indicate that before you made your move, so that's cool with me. What else you got to say?
Yes, sir, and so right now we are working on the international strategy, and we are in the phase of raising the awareness amongst the African-American community and the international community of the African-Americans' right to return, to create an independent nation, and to rule themselves without interference from anyone else. So that's
okay.
that's the phase we are in right now.
Good luck.
Yes, sir. We have nothing to lose.
Got that right. When you sleep on the floor, you can't fall out of bed.
Mr. Greenlee.
That's a good one.
Mr. Greenlee.
Yeah.
I have another caller. Someone else has their hand up. 301, your line is open. State your name where you're calling from.
Yes,
thank
you,
Chef Rob. This is B.A. How you doing, brother?
All right. How you doing, bro?
Oh, great, great, great. You caught me by surprise. You know, I was just out trolling about and saw your show, and you have a fantastic, terrific author and poet on tonight, Mr. Greenlee. Hello, Mr. Greenlee.
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing fine. Now,
where are you calling from?
Well, I'm calling from Maryland, outside of D.C.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Now, you wrote the book, The Spook Who Sat by the Door, was published in 68, am I correct?
What's that?
Was the book published in 1969. My question to you, sir, is 2010. Looking at where we've come from since, say, 68, 69, can you write The Spook Who Sat by the Door today? And today, I mean, I'm sure you can, but do you think it'll have the resonance that it had in 68, 69? You know, given, you know, we have, of course, the first black president, we're told we have all this opportunity out here. And in addition to that, the vibe in the black community as a result of, say, the drug epidemic of the, you know, 20 years ago, it appears to me that black people are of a different ilk today, that the revolutionary spirit that we had that made your book such a lasting success. Have we gotten any better? I'm involved a little bit in politics, ran for school board, and that zeal that I get from reading your book, that sort of the man in society who's going to make all things better, who's going to work against the system, who's going to organize the people, you know, and do things in a very stealth, intelligent manner, you know, not all into, you know, the frat thing, the sorority thing. I think we've lost traction, we've lost ground, though it appears that we've gained ground, but I just don't get that sense today that we've progressed in a way that, you know, the community is able to appreciate your work.
Well, they're still reading it, and they seem to like it, but situation has changed. I always describe it in this way: two steps forward, one step back. We've made progress, but we lost ground on a number of levels. Lost ground in terms of economic self-reliance. We spent more money on our own community in the 30s than we do today. We had more and stronger businesses than we did today. But there's no reason why we can't do what our ancestors did in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and down into the 60s.
Why do you think we haven't progressed economically? Alone, you know, we progressed, of course, politically. We got more black elected officials than we ever thought we would have. But somehow the jobs and the economics are just, I mean, we got less now than we had 40 years ago.
Because the present generation are less interested in establishing businesses.
Right, right.
Back in the day, we had to do it because we didn't have no choice. One of the reasons that there was so much independent black businesses in Chicago is the people who migrated from the Deep South. They had to establish their own businesses because white folks didn't provide those services. Nowadays, you got whites who will do what they wouldn't do 50 years ago. And unfortunately, we're not producing the kinds of young men and women who've got that entrepreneurial spirit. That's not completely true. I think all of us know of young black men and women who are operating businesses in the community.
Right.
You can say we could do more, but you can't say we don't do anything. So I encourage black students when I go to colleges and universities, think about opening your own business, man. Why would you want to work for somebody else when you could be the boss? You can be your own boss.
Has there been any talk of an updated movie version?
Man, an updated version would be sci-fi fantasy. The gangs ain't going to start no revolution, man.
Okay.
They're part of the system.
Right, right, right.
They're crypto-capitalists in for profit, period. Can you imagine a modern street gang, if you walked up to them and said, let's overthrow the government, they'd laugh in your face. So, no, if somebody wanted to do a period piece, I'd say, yeah. And I've turned down offers to update it for that reason.
You ever did anyone ever approach you about a sequel or a series of books? I mean, it's great the way it is. I mean, of course, like you said, it's selling today, and it's going to always sell. It's a monumental piece of work. Has anyone approached you about a sequel? Or
I've been approached about update, and I turned them down.
Okay.
If somebody wanted to do it as a period piece, I'd go for it. But ain't nobody going to believe that modern street gang is going to start no revolution.
Right. Right. Well, I thank you, sir. I appreciate you taking the time and taking my call, and I appreciate it. You know, I read your book in the late 80s. It was 87. You know,
uh-huh.
My brother was a bartender, handed it to me, you know, and I didn't know what I was getting into. Didn't know what I was about to read because I'd never heard of it before. But you know, I couldn't believe what it was the quickest book I ever read. I couldn't put it down. You know, I gave it back to him 2 days later. You know, mm-hmm. It was. I mean, and then later in college, I actually saw the movie, and the furthest thing from my mind that it was actually a movie. Based on this book, because I had read the book first, and when I saw the movie, I remember one of the brothers, because I'm a bit of a movie, you know, I watched a lot of movies of the 70s, and one of the brothers that was in the movie, the light-skinned brother, I know he had played in Sonny Carson, and I remember him from there. And I,
no, he wasn't in Sonny Carson.
Oh, no, the
you confused him with another actor.
Oh, was another, oh, he wasn't, oh, oh, okay, okay, I thought he was, he looked similar to one of the actors that was in, okay, okay, but when I saw it, now who directed the movie?
Ivan Dixon.
Ivan, oh, right, right, from Nothing But a Man.
Right.
Yes, yes, okay, okay, yeah, when I saw it, well, then it all makes sense then, it all makes sense, Ivan Dixon was a powerful actor, so it all makes sense that he would know what to do with this piece of work. And I enjoyed the DVD, the film as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was re-released, wasn't it? Not too long ago.
Yeah, on DVD about 5 years ago.
Okay,
and it's been. Distributed by Tim and Daphne Reed.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it's black all the way.
Right.
Black
right,
produced,
right.
Black financed, and now it's black distributed.
Hmm.
Yeah, okay. I don't talk about nationalism. I do it.
Right.
Love
right,
it.
Right. You got any opinions about the current state of, I guess, what we would call Black Hollywood? I guess the Tyler Perry I don't know if you're familiar, franchise, type of work.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one of the top black directors or black filmmakers out there today. I know he's not producing anything, that we would consider to be nationalism or revolutionary. But again,
it's harmless soap opera, man.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It offers escape for particularly working class black women. And who needs escape any more than us? I like escapist films. Westerns are my favorite. So I ain't got no problem with Tyler Perry. He's not doing anything against us, and I wish him well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, one other thing. Now, Paula Kelly was in the movie, correct?
Right.
Okay. And who was the lead? I can't remember.
Lawrence Cook.
Lawrence Cook. Okay.
Harlem brother.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivan grew up in Harlem too.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay, brother, I appreciate it. I thank you, sir, for taking my call. And I thank you, Chef Rob. I appreciate it.
No problem. Glad you called. Come back. One thing I want to go ahead and I want to ask you, Mr. Greenlee, because I extended it for a little bit so we can go ahead and get some more questions. But I want to ask you, can we do this again?
Anytime.
I love it. I'm going to try to go ahead and get you out here and see how we can go, because I think that education is the key, and your book is a big cog in that educating our people. Go ahead and let them know that we can do something if we just stick together. You know what I'm saying?
Got that right.
So it's a lot of us out here that are trying to do some work, like Captain Hit on the line. Brother Rick is over there too. And, it's a lot of people out here that's trying to do some stuff. Any more questions for Mr. Greenlee?
Yes, I do, Mr. Greenlee. This is David Hitt again. And once again, sir, it is a true honor to have been able to listen to you, and I definitely want to get your phone number so that we can talk in detail and hopefully that we can do things that will honor you and hopefully honor us in the long term. We are very serious about doing something for ourselves, and as I mentioned before, sir, some of us have want to take their professionalism and our professional expertise and use that towards the betterment of ourselves as African Americans. My grandfather has told me many times that when he was growing up in Alabama, how fascinating a time it was for the African-American in the sense of they just did things for themselves. They were doctors. They were dentists. They owned stores. They were their own farmers. They built their, made their own tools. And unfortunately, due to the integration, I mean, my grandfather honestly will tell me today, he says that black folks were better off back then in the sense of they were able to take care of themselves. And now we've lost that today. We don't have people, or we have very few people today that understand how to install an electrical system, how to change a light bulb, how to change a switch, how to design plumbing, how to build a home. And so in my experience of living overseas and watching the jungle and the desert transform into a city beyond belief, I mean, sir, Singapore and Malaysia is raw beyond belief what they've done over there building-wise. And it is our intention, sir, and until my last breath, that we as 21st century African Americans, those of us who are of the ilk in which you wrote in your book, because we are masters of war ourselves. As a former captain in the Marine Corps, I learned the art of war, and I learned the importance of mastering that, the art of war. And by being able to physically do stuff for ourselves, if you teach a man how to build a home, then he's never homeless. And so we hope that you will give us your support, sir. If you don't, I can understand that, but we do hope that you would give us your support in the sense of this noble effort and this noble cause is designed for one purpose, and that is to be able to create an accurate interpretation of the world to our children for the future, and to firmly and finally control our political, social, and economic destiny forever. Simply put, we have the right to be on our own. Thank you very much, sir. And I look forward to following up with you, and thank you so much for what you've done for us, sir.
Thanks for calling.
I want to ask you about one other thing before we go ahead and we close. About present-day leadership and Barack Obama being the president. Okay, and I want you to go ahead. You can go back as far as you want to. But how did, you know, just like today, a lot of people say, hey, they don't think there ever would be a black president, even a half-black president, whatever you want to call it. So how do you feel about this president?
Well, I think he has enormous symbolic value for the community, but I don't think he's doing anything of particular value for the community. Colin Powell best described him as a president who happens to be black. You can't judge him as a black president. You just got to judge his performance by that of any other president. And I'm just disappointed in his performance today.
What has been his biggest disappointment to you?
The fact that he won't get nose to nose with his opponents and push his stuff through. He's so busy trying to be well liked that he seemingly don't know how to kick ass. He got the power. He ain't got to be going on his knees begging Republicans to do anything. He had an overwhelming majority in both the Democrats in both the House and the Senate. And what has he accomplished during that time? And what is he going to do once that's turned around? The Republicans are a majority in the House beginning next month, and the majority in the Senate has been sorely kicked. What is he going to do? No, I think his performance today as president is dismal. I wish I could say otherwise.
And locally?
What's that?
And locally, what about Chicago politics?
Oh, ain't nothing happening in Chicago politics since Hal Washington died.
Oh, that's crazy, isn't it? See, I agree with what you said about Barack Obama, and the thing that really, really bugs me is that he spent time here in Chicago.
And didn't learn a damn thing.
Let me chime in real quick. And sir, I agree with you and Brother Rob. And once again, and it just shows that without the true power of a legislative majority for ourselves, nothing is going to get done. And you're right. He has been an appeaser. He has been more concerned about being accepted by more people than being able to stand up and take a stand. I think that he misses the element of black rage. I don't think he has that within himself to be able to stand up and truly fight for what is right for our people. But at the same time, fundamentally, we only have 43 congressmen. We represent 10% of the Congress. We have no representation in the Senate right now. And to some people, we have no representation on the Supreme Court. So how are we going to change this country in any way when, by definition, the government is run by a constitution, and the constitution states the majority rules? We're outnumbered. And I think that it is an illusion to the African-American people if they think that we're all of a sudden going to get jobs and et cetera and all of this and that and own companies. I mean, I go around here in New York on Long Island and go out to various businesses, and I cannot tell you how few businesses that I see that are African-American. And I believe it is the only way for us to do that, like every other culture in the world. When you see a Pakistani, when you see an Indian, a Chinese, a Korean, they all have a country to go back to. Every culture in the world has a nation state. And we as the African-American people, which represent a new culture that was created since the times of slavery, who are 40 million, we are the 15th largest economy in the world. We are the 33rd largest nation based on individual population. We're two times the size of Iraq today. We are 20 times the size of Kuwait, seven times the size of Israel. So we have the right to be a nation.
Hold on, let me say this. Just as that other brother talked about his Alabama grandparents, we had more black business during the 30s, during the Depression.
That's right, sir.
Than we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no intention of reforming white America. I want to leave them out there where they are.
Agreed.
I want to reform black America. I want us to return to the spirit of economic, social, and political independence that I observed in my young manhood and childhood. I never expected Obama to do anything of particular value to us as a people. I've been watching that cat for 10 years, and I'm not the least bit surprised at what he's done. In fact, I didn't vote for him because I knew who he was, and I knew what he was going to do, and I knew what he was not going to do. So although I'm disappointed, I'm not surprised.
Agreed, sir.
And as I say, and as a military man, you can relate to this. We have to do an about-face.
Yes, sir.
And start facing inward instead of outward towards white folks. And to do what our ancestors did so well. Rebuild. Go ahead.
Can I interject this, right? Because I've been having this conversation with a lot of people. And it's about the irrelevancy that we may become on an economic basis if we don't wake up and start putting businesses in our own community. You know, instead of, you know, it's like every time you pick up any mechanical or no matter what it is, it's all, everything's made in China. And when China opens up to capitalism, right, we're going to become irrelevant. They're going to start selling that junk to themselves. And then we're going to be sitting over here, you know, trying to, you know, to figure out, you know, why we don't have jobs, because they're all overseas. They've been outsourced, and we're trying to do, you know, too much.
Hold on, wait a minute. The Chinese were practicing capitalism before the word came into being. They might be communistic in terms of government, but in terms of their economy, they're better at capitalism nowadays than we are.
Well, indeed, that's what I'm saying.
They are already practicing capitalism.
Well, I'm saying in terms of the markets being opened up in terms of, you know, European businesses and American businesses going over there and, you know, capitalizing on their, what you call that, legalized slavery. Because, of, you know, their minimum wage doesn't compare to a minimum wage over here in America. So, you know, they're making 25 and 50 cents on a dollar. You have workers dying weekly, committing suicide because they're not meeting up to the standards of their production value. You know, and then, you know, I mean, they open up a mall, like one of the largest malls in the world, and it's empty because they thought all these people were going to jump in there, you know, because of all this westernization being imprint, you know, imprinted in their minds as to how they're supposed to be living. So,
now,
you
know. What has China got to do with us?
Say it again?
What has China got to do with us as a people? I can tell you one thing. Many of the well-paid factory jobs were here in Chicago when I was growing up are now in China.
Well, that's
between
exactly what I'm saying.
In 1960, 50% of the factories in the Chicago area closed down. So, I'm with you. But that shows how stupid white folks are. Who is going to buy all of these high-ticket items here in the United States if every year more and more people are forced into flipping hamburgers?
Yeah, the Chinese, in my experience, too, the Chinese culture of people, like Mr. Greenlee said, they are capitalists. They are the consummate businessmen. And they keep things within their own community. When you as an African American, I ask, and I was talking to Brother Rob today, you think, how many Chinese gave you business in this country? And I can tell you none, for myself. You go to a Chinaman and you say to him, I want to sell you this, I want to sell you that. Very few, if any, African Americans will be able to penetrate their, quote, Chinatown or their communities. But we as African Americans, we're buying stuff from them every single day. You ask a Chinaman, how many black people are buying products and services from you? They'll tell you every single day. We got them lined up right outside of our Chinese restaurant. And what we've got to learn from them is it is the nation state. When you have the nation state, you have the ability to make the laws so of commerce, and your laws of commerce, the laws that we will design for this new nation, will make sure that products and services are bought by African Americans. That's the way it works. You're not going to China at all. And for the Chinese culture, the Buddhist philosophy, they have that philosophy of everybody together for one cause. And if they are, if they're brought up in a small village, they may have the desire to be wealthy. But if they are a peasant for their whole life,
look,
that is their mentality.
We
used
to do exactly what you're talking about.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I live on 63rd Street. And about a mile on 63rd Street, there were shops on every street, shoulder to shoulder. Now, they got about six hovering around 63rd and Cottage Grove.
Mm-hmm.
All of those shops are gone. And the majority of them were owned by black people. So it's not that we don't know how to do it. Our ancestors did it. The problem is we stopped doing it. And the results are obvious. We don't have to emulate the Chinese or the Buddhists. We had a community that was virtually self-reliant. You didn't have to leave the ghetto to get anything of importance, and most of what you got, you could go right down the street to a black business. So if we did it before, how come we can't do it again?
That's exactly right, sir. I totally agree. And if we don't go back to that, then we are never going to get out of this, quote, condition.
And if we don't, it's our own fault.
That's right.
We can't go around blaming all of our problems on white folks. A lot of them create for ourselves.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
The people selling dope aren't white.
Yep.
The people who are killing one another in the streets aren't white. the people who will walk past a black business and drive 10 miles downtown to patronize a white establishment are stupid. We didn't do it when I was growing up. First of all, because we couldn't. We weren't welcome down there. And now, Chicago, the South Side of Chicago, is a virtual economic and cultural desert. If you want to hear jazz, you want to hear blues, you got to leave the hood. If you want to go to a decent restaurant, you got a choice of three. When I was growing up, they had a couple of dozen. Why is it? I'll give you a metaphor of why. There was this farmer who bought some cattle seed. And it was edible, but it didn't smell right. So the cattle wouldn't eat it. So one night when the cattle were asleep, he put a rickety fence up around the cattle feed. And the next morning, the cattle knocked it down to get to it. Like cattle, we as a people ran to where we had been wanted the week before just because we couldn't get there the week before. We got to overcome that white nonsense. That ice is colder if you die from a white man. We had more pride in the community when I was growing up than we do today. And I go out to the poetry sets, and all I hear is these young poets cussing and complaining about white folks.
Exactly.
And where they doing it? In a white-owned joint, white man sitting behind the cash register taking their money and laughing all the way to the bank.
Exactly.
Oh man, that's crazy. All right, fellas. We got about 1 minute left. Anybody got any closing thoughts? We'll go around the table. We'll start with you, Big Rick.
Nah, nothing. It was an honor and a pleasure, to hear your thoughts and Black Power and Peace.
Thank you, brother. Captain Hitt?
Sir, I would love to emulate what the brother said. Yes, it was an absolute honor, sir, and thank you very much for all that you've done to contribute towards the greatness of our people.
Yeah, brother, and when you establish that nation, send me a one-way ticket.
You got it, sir. You got it, sir. I swear to God, by hook or crook, I'm gonna get you on that plane, and you can do whatever the hell you got to do, and you'll be very surprised at what we will build, sir. We will build some of the best. I will promise you that.
Thank you. Mr. Greenlee.
Yeah.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. I want to hear your final thoughts and views, but first, I need to have that commitment. You are going to come back. We're going to have to do this again, right?
Anytime.
Can we get your number again, sir?
773-288-6877. I repeat, 773-288-6877. And I want to sign off with this short poem. Once upon a time, they used to own slaves. Nowadays, they rent to us.
Can't get no shorter than that.
I agree.
And with that note, buddy, showing up. All the people that were listening, and you guys have a good night.
Thank you so much, Rob. Excellent job, Rob. Excellent job.
Thank
you, brother. Take care now.
All right,
yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Let comfort of your happy home. Don't you worry, pretty baby.
When the sun goes down, I say a prayer for you.